You're listening to the Bethel University Chapel Podcast, recorded from the Everstwar Chapel Fine Arts Center in Mishawaka, Indiana. Thanks for listening.
You can be seated. Yeah, we're very thankful for all of our fellow students who help lead us in worship, so let's thank them, would we, with an applause? Put a lot of time in. They put a lot of time in, and so we appreciate them. Well, there's a lot of serious things going on in the world, right? I mean, we've got the triple vector thing going on. We have the virus. We have the economic fallout from the virus. And I'm sorry to acknowledge it's true. I mean, many of your households have been affected by that. And, of course, all of the racial reckoning that's going on. So a lot of serious things. But don't you think we need to do a few things to relax a little bit, have a little fun? Right, we should? All right, so we have a giveaway today, a little bit of fun. I've got some friends in the booth who are going to help us set the mood. Here it is. Oh, we've got some game show music. So I have a giveaway. There's somebody in this room who is near a piece of masking tape like this, taped to the back of a seat. There's only one in the auditorium. If you see it, you're the person. We want you to come on down, as the game show hosts say. You got it. All right. Here he is in the back. I think it's a he. Come on down. Come on down. And here, come right down here, would you? We'll bring you up real quick. Got to have a little bit of fun around here while there's weirdness in the world. All right. Let's find out who the winner is. Come right over here in the light so everybody can see you. Hey, congratulations. So, tell everybody what's your name.
Ezra Babs.
Say it again.
Ezra Babs.
All right. And what major have you chosen to study?
Youth Ministry and Worship Arts.
Okay. And what's your hometown?
South Bend.
Okay. Local. So, we have something for you, and it's over here underneath the blanket. Just a little bit of fun for you and some friends. This is a customized cornhole, the BU stuff. So there we are. Hope you like it. Yeah, good, kind of fun. So a little heavy and a little bulky. So please come down right after the service and we've got some folks who will help you get it to a car or wherever you want it to be. But that's for you, all right? All right, congratulations to him. There we are. Yes, a little bit of fun. Well, I'm happy to have this moment with you starting this week of chapel. And we are kicking off a series that's really sprinkled throughout the academic year. Seven speakers, and it is called Windows and Mirrors. You see what's over my head. Windows and Mirrors, discussions on race, justice, and the kingdom of God. And if we didn't think this was necessary, here we go again over, I think it was Sunday night, Jacob Blake in Wisconsin. We just seem to be, our culture is reckoning on these issues. And I'm going to talk today about how it's part of our community life. So hold on with me for that. The speakers that we're going to have really are people of significance. One person is J.C. Watts. He'll be a speaker to you in the spring. Former U.S. Congressman, former Sugar Bowl champion twice, and founder of the Black News Channel, which is on Xfinity, started this year. Also, we'll have Randy Melville. He's a senior vice president with Frito-Lay, so if you enjoy your chips, he's the guy behind that. A man of color, great Christian brother. He'll come and talk about his life, and many others as well. But I want to talk to you briefly about a mirror, and then a window, and a second mirror. We're going to begin with Ecclesiastes 7:10. Just to remind you, the book that we're about to look at was written by Solomon, also wrote Proverbs, probably wrote Proverbs as a young man, but Ecclesiastes as an older man. Sadly, part of Solomon's story is he sinned, repented, and recovered, like all of us in one respect. He had his own issues. So the book of Ecclesiastes that we're looking at today was written as kind of a penance book. It's you're hearing from a guy who blew it and recovered in God and wants to share the wisdom that he's learned from that. So let's look together here, Ecclesiastes 7:10. This is the wisest person that ever lived, And of course, with the authority of revelation from God himself, we're hearing from God, but through Solomon, do not say, why were the old days better than these? It's not wise to ask that kind of question. And this is certainly relevant now while we are all dealing with a triple vector crisis. It'd be easy to ask, why couldn't my college experience or my family life or my community be like it was before? We're being censored from that kind of thinking and talk today. It's important to know that the original language this was written in Hebrew, is talking about don't ask this question. It's not saying don't take your questions to God generally. It's not saying don't be in a posture of lament and even complaint to God. He can handle that. He invites that. But this is really saying don't ask this particular question or this sentiment expressed in similar words. It might be that you could think, I have an older brother or an older sister. Why can't my college years be like theirs were, untroubled by things like our time? Why would God censor us from asking ourselves or thinking and talking about, man, I wish it was like the good old days? I think it's because he wants us to manage our memory, because our memories can abuse us. For example, one type of memory that distorts our view of present-day life is nostalgia. Nostalgia is a kind of memory that exaggerates or glorifies the past even bigger than it really was. Sort of like retelling a fish story. The more you tell it, the fish was bigger, the fight was more grand than it really was. That kind of distortion of the past is an incomplete depiction of the reality, and what it does is it makes us an incompetent judge of our present time. Nostalgia of the past that glorifies us makes it feel like our present time is worse by comparison than it really is. For example, I grew up in the 1970s, and I could say, oh, my childhood was so free from concern. The 70s were a great era. But you know what? I Googled the 1970s, and the very first blog I found said this, and I'm quoting from a blog, the 70s were crap. That's exactly what he said. He said, it's one of those things that everybody knows. The unions held the country for ransom, garbage piled up in the streets, electrical power cuts were frequent, and the fashions were embarrassing. Well, let's travel back to the 1970s, because here you go on the screen. You've got two pictures, and on the left is my wife, Tammy. I hope you get to know her. She's not here today, but she's often here in chapel. And I told her I was showing a picture, and she worried. I said, don't worry, it's the cute one. So there she is with all the curls. But there, on the right, I mean, come on, smoking hot, right? The leisure suit in white. Notice the collar. I think it's like, is it like rose-colored? I don't know what that shirt is. The big collar out to the shoulders. So here is my memory of the 70s. I'm thinking, I was fashionable. I was cool. But if I'm too consumed with my confidence, with my threads, it distorts my judgment of today because I could have too much confidence and get a little off, right? So nostalgia is a problem. So a mirror question for you to look at yourself would be this. Am I making more of something in my past than I really should? There's a different kind of memory that we need to manage. I'd call it amnesia. We blunt learning for our current time if we block out things that we don't remember on purpose. And this is the reason that when I came to Bethel in 2013, right away in my conference room, I hung a picture of Bethel's first president, Woodrow Goodman. If you came in today, and I welcome you to visit whenever you're interested, but it's there. Why would I put that there? The first president is literally looking over my shoulder as I do my work every day. I'm doing that because I honor our forefathers and foremothers. I remember their heritage of audacity. The very first class of 93 students that came from all over the place, they came to a first year school, cobbled together that first board. I don't want to block my life from that memory. In fact, their memory inspires me. It makes me think the challenges of today are small, in fact, compared to what they went through. So a mirror question, again, an amnesia would be, Should I face something from my past that I'm suppressing? So if nostalgia and amnesia are distorted memories, how should we manage our memory? Let's call it faithful remembrance. All of us have suffered in some way, but clearly we have suffered unevenly. And you have to manage your memory about that. A.W. Tozer advises us how to do that in his book, The Knowledge of the Holy, where he says, memory can overtake your imagination. I think what he's saying is our struggle in life can sap our belief, or our struggle in life can inspire our hope that God will still break through. So imagine you're in Sufficient Grounds across the street, you're talking with a crowd of people, and you're hearing from someone who for years has been collecting sour memories. It's like ugly art in their mind. And everything they have to say is sadness, disappointment. What does that do to their expectation for the future? They're the kinds of people that would say, I can't expect that God will intervene in this. Apparently, he doesn't care. I have no hope in him for that. But in that same conversation, there's a person who also has suffered, sometimes deeply, but what do they talk about? They intentionally recall moments of God coming through for them. Or if they don't have that personal memory, they tell the stories of how God came through dramatically for somebody else, or maybe even from the scripture. All of their managed memory is from God's faithfulness. Now, this expands their imagination for what God might do for them in their future. You see the relationship: sour memory, small imagination, vivid memory, and large imagination, vibrant imagination. So I think that's probably what Solomon's saying to us, and God is saying, I censor you, I want to suppress your speech and thought. Don't have conversations about, oh, why couldn't it be better than my time, better than it was before? Because we have to manage our memory, it can do damage to us. I want you to massage into your pain the medicine of hopeful imagination for what God might do in your life this week, this month, this year. Well, in about 15 minutes, I want to introduce to you two people that I would call people of faithful remembrance. It's Dr. Christian Mihut and Ms. Ian Thompson. They are part of our community that is leading on one of the three crises of our time, but you're not going to find them in the nurse's office helping do COVID tests, and you're not going to find them in the financial aid office helping with the economic impact on your life from COVID. On that third rail of what we're all coping with, racial reckoning, racial pain, they're leaders in this. So this is a chance for us to pull out a window to look through what's right now a wall to us and see each other for racial pain and racial effects. I was reminded last week during some of the political conventions that we're on that the late senator and civil rights activist John Lewis was honored in many ways. There was a documentary made about his life where he said, never ever be afraid to make some noise and get in good trouble. I'll acknowledge that I'm going to get in a little good trouble with you this morning. This is not necessarily a fun topic to open our year with, but it is good trouble, and I think our community will benefit from it. So last year, let me help you remember the context of coming in to this year. Last year, we did some studies to learn what you think about our climate. I don't mean our weather, but our relationship climate. We heard from 1,300 people in a couple of ways. One is, some of you who are returning students would remember we did the Race Card Project, where students anonymously wrote six words of what they feel or think about race. Second thing we did is we hired a firm out of Pennsylvania, a man to come in who is skilled to conduct focus groups and one-on-one interviews to go really deep. And then third, a very large and broad thing, there was a firm out of Washington, D.C. that we hired to do web-based surveys. So in all that, we heard from 1,300 people. So I'm gonna summarize here on the screen 200 pages of results, and I want you to know what our community is saying to one another or really feels inside about our climate. So there's a couple of lists. There's several things that you'd say were good news from hearing what you think. 9 out of 10 of our students and our workforce say they're satisfied with their choice of Bethel to work or study here. Also, over a decade, the percentage of students of color has doubled. That's only the diversity side of the equation. But the third one there is more the inclusion side. Apparently, compared to other colleges and universities, there's 10 that we compare ourselves to, we have a graduation rate for students of color that's more than 20% better. There's actually a national expert who said that's the master metric of inclusion. That's good. And then when we asked people, name the positive traits when you think of Bethel, this is what they said. They said, when I think of Bethel, I think about it being Christ-centered, community-connected, kind, and professors who help you succeed. That's good. But of course, there's a list where we need to improve. And you'll see here, when we asked people to name negative traits when they think about Bethel, there were three themes: non-inclusive, expensive, and too strict. Also, there was a theme that white students were frustrated with Bethel. They felt like we're talking about race issues too much. In fact, there was a theme where particularly some white students, enough white students as a pattern, not all, felt that by talking about race, it's actually creating a division that wouldn't exist if we wouldn't talk about it at all. And then last, you see there, the focus group leader took a quote from one student that he thought represented a lot of the input, and it's there. The institution wants all people to come, but the people of Bethel aren't ready for all people to come. So just a quick word about the strictness thing. Hey, we're sponsoring dances now. Some of you last year got part of that. Although with COVID, I guess, I don't know if we can't do as much, I don't know, dance 6 feet apart or something like that. And we've extended open hours in dorms, so there's some things. We're trying to be more reflective about that. In terms of that it's expensive, I know it's hard for you. But if a student is looking for a private Christian school, the group we compare to are actually in the bottom third. Average debt, when people finish, but I know that that's hard for you. But let me focus then on the diversity and inclusion part. One of the top negative traits was non-inclusive. Now, on the left side, I'm glad that every year we're growing in the proportion of students of color, and I'm glad that there's a great graduation rate compared to others. But clearly, that good news is eclipsed by our community telling us our inclusion is an incomplete project. Race is a really tough problem because it's easier to create programs or trainings than it is to affect people's attitudes or experiences. Part of my challenge is that while there are clearly exceptions in your experiences, I have to talk in generalities now. I know that there are white people, for example, who've had enormous challenges to overcome. It's miraculous that they're even here, for example. I know that's true. So in a minute, I'm going to talk about things that are generally true, not true for every person. So I have a lot to say on that topic, but I only have time to talk about one thing. I'll talk about that, and then I want to introduce two folks to you, and then we'll be done. The one thing I'd like to pick up is there was a theme of white students saying that by talking about this more often than they're comfortable with, it's creating a problem that wouldn't exist. So I want to open up a window about that. So I'm entering a moment here where I'm kind of talking white guy to white gals and guys, and if you're a person of color, you get to eavesdrop. But I'd like to talk with you for a few minutes. We just heard from Solomon censoring us from reminiscing about the good old days. If you open a window to really look at the life and the experience in America of a person of color, generally, there haven't been good old days. It's a very different experience. The history has been brutal. And here we are, of course, the events of the summer and George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery, and here we are again in Wisconsin with Jacob Blake. Just keep looking through the window. Keep looking at
our race differences. The feeling for a person of color is legitimized when they see a news event like, well, excuse me, it's not really a news event, it's a tragic life event, but George Floyd, or now even most recently, Jacob Blake. White people tend to intellectualize that as a news item, but for persons of color, I've learned that they're psychologically and emotionally attached to it. It's like, that could have been me. Why is that? Because virtually every week in America, a person of color has a friction point that reminds them that people see them for their color. The problem is that we have a biology that's corrupting our sociology. A superficial thing like skin pigment, we are attributing things to one another, and it corrupts how we relate together as groups. I know that the effect on persons of color from so-called news items hurts and is real, because in modern time, I have many friends of color who still today are called the N-word, who still today are walking into a store to buy something and they're mistaken for the help, who still today are thought criminals for just driving through town. Well, what do we say about that? That sounds general. Let me be more personal. This summer, I called our friends, colleagues, brothers and sisters in the faith, people of color, students, trustees, faculty, staff. What words did they describe for how they feel now? And we'll put them on the screen. If you're tempted to not believe this, believe what I just said, believe this. They said, I'm distraught. I'm grieved. I'm spent and fatigued. I'm angry. I'm at a boiling point. One person observed, why is it that white people tend to speak up for pro-life for babies, but they don't speak out at all about George Floyd or other cases we're aware of? There's a betrayal of silence by my friends who are white when they say nothing at all. They won't stand up for me. One said, racism in my life is just so obvious, I can't believe there are people who don't see it and they deny it. I know a white person could hear this and could feel like, you know, I didn't create this mess, so it's not my responsibility, but I'd like you to think of it this way. The home you live in, you did not construct. But because you live there now, you're responsible for its care. You cannot walk out of the house this morning past an overflowing clogged toilet and say, I didn't create that mess, somebody else has to deal with it. This is your home. This is where you live. You have to care for the environment that you live in now. So I want to pull out another mirror, and just for us white folks to look at ourselves a little bit. There's just three things I'm going to say, then I'm done about this. Let's just look at ourselves. One, the definitions I've learned really matter. I've learned that white people and people of color define racism very differently. The mere word racism is a moral word, and it puts up our defenses. We obviously, nobody wants to be accused of that or even it be suggested, but the definition matters. What I've learned is most, not all, white people, racism to them is a conscious, willful, mean-spirited action against someone based on their skin color. If that's your definition, a lot of people could excuse themselves and say, I don't do that, so I'm not racist. And I would agree if that's your definition. But our project at Bethel more likely is something different. A definition that is, there are insensitive and unconscious moments that still create needless friction in the lives of people of color and remind them that they're viewed a certain way based on that. By the way, learning about this, getting in the mirror, is actually a workforce skill. My own son, who's 22, just got his first, you know, kind of big boy job out of college, the one you'll have soon. He's gone through all kinds of trainings in his first week about these things. He's a white guy, but his company wants him to look in the mirror and understand these dynamics. So the definition matters. Well, a person could say, if it's unconscious, then how can I be held responsible for it? Think like this. Psalm 19 is very motivating to me. It says, the cry of a heart posture of prayer. The psalmist said, oh Lord, forgive my willful sins, but also forgive my hidden faults. Then I'll be blameless before you. So you see, even from God's vantage point, your motive can be innocent, but the effect you can still be blamed for. So our posture should be, I don't want to do anything willfully or even unconsciously that would subordinate someone like that. I want to monitor myself so somebody else doesn't have to monitor me. The second of the last three things is, I've learned that as we keep looking in the mirror, that most white people never reflect on their whiteness, whereas persons of color have to reflect on their race. I think it's kind of like this. Don't ever ask a fish to reflect on the water. He's so immersed in it, he never has to think about it. The fish doesn't even know what water is. In fact, the fish knows in the ocean feeds him. He has a positive expectation about the water, the environment he's in. He knows the water mostly doesn't ever threaten him. So to reflect on whiteness is a hard thing, because if you're majority culture, the culture's feeding you generally, and you don't have to think about its friction points. Let me give you some examples from a book. This is a controversial book, I admit that. Robin DiAngelo, she's a white researcher. She wrote a best-selling book called White Fragility. And though it is controversial and I don't agree with everything she says, I endorse what I'm about to read to you. I'm reading now in her voice. She's helping people, helping white people understand the effect of whiteness. When I turn on the TV and look at magazines and drive past billboards, I see myself everywhere, and intuitively, I just know I belong. When I read Hemingway or Steinbeck or Charles Dickens, I'll never be told they're white writers. But when I read Maya Angelou or Toni Morrison or James Baldwin, I'll be told they're black writers. People are trying to suggest to me they are writing from a certain perspective. Be wary of that perspective. But I'm never told that the white writers have a perspective, which of course they do. And because of that, I never feel the burden of my color. I never need to reflect on it. I never need to worry if my color will be held against me. I will never walk into an establishment where I am applying for a job and find, I'll never walk into an establishment and be mistaken for the staff when I'm a customer. And when I'm employed, probably everybody that hires me and works with me looks like me. More than that, once hired, I won't have to deal with my coworkers' resentment that I only got the job because I'm white. It never occurs to me. And because of that, I have full freedom of movement. I never have to think about how to handle myself when the police pull me over, or when I'm the only person at the meeting or the party who looks like me, or when I'm stared at for moving into a neighborhood that's different than my race. I'm breaking out of the voice of that author now and coming back to my voice. You see the connection to Ecclesiastes 7:10. If we're looking in the mirror, when people talk nostalgically about the good old days, I know what they mean as a white man, because generally my life has been marked by good old days. But for so many around us, it's almost laughable to talk about the good old days, because they haven't been that at all. In fact, day in, day out in our culture, they're still not. Despite all of the work of law, we still see patterns that you can't attribute to individual traits. For example, the unemployment rate for blacks is double of whites. Black infant mortality is double that of whites. COVID kills people of color at higher rates than whites. While only 1 in 10 murders of black people are by white persons, it's still true that blacks are 2.5 times more likely to be pulled over by police, twice more likely to be arrested, 5 times more likely to be incarcerated, and get longer sentences from the judge for the same crime as whites. And on the list goes. The scale of those things cannot be attributed to individual characteristics. You couldn't say, well, it tends to be true that black or brown households have 1/3 less the income than whites. You can't say that's not because people don't work hard or people don't know how to save or something like that. There must be something else going on. So third and last, I have an ask for you today. And it's this, two things. One, looking in the mirror, I'm asking white people in particular, but really all of us, to remain curious and humble about the water. Start thinking about how the culture feeds you or how the culture might be threatening to someone else. Don't be haughty. Don't be pride-filled. Be humble and curious about that. And the second and last thing is, don't think that being friendly to a person of color is heroic. Actually, we expect that. But move from being friendly to actually being friends with a person of color. And you know the difference. For example, if you're friendly, you smile and wave on a sidewalk. If you're friends, you walk with that person and talk with them on the sidewalk. If you're friendly, you sit next to a person that's different than you in a classroom, but if you're friends, you sit together over a meal. If you're friendly, you keep from saying anything that's offensive, but if you're friends, you defend them when something offensive happens. And on the list goes. A friendly person wishes them a good weekend. A friend spends time with them on the weekend. So in summary, I think I do understand why Solomon is censoring us from talking about the good old days. Resist amnesia, resist nostalgia, but also understand that there's a faithful remembrance that's Godward, particularly on the topic of racial tension, that is a gift to our community. We are perfectly situated to be a what the Bible calls a peculiar people, strange and different. When people drive by our campus or they learn about us, they say, it's different there. Why is it? It would be God in us that on this topic, things are very different. So with that, I want to invite our two friends. They will close our time together. Thanks for coming up. This is Dr. Mihut and Ms. Thompson.
Thanks for listening to the Bethel University Chapel podcast. Subscribe to the podcast and get more information at chapel.betheluniversity.edu or check us out on the iTunes store by searching for Bethel University Chapel.